You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Welcome to another episode of the City of Man podcast. My name is Coyle Neal. I am an assistant professor of political science at Southwest Baptist University in Bolivar, Missouri. Joining me in the studio today, and by studio I mean SBU's Science College's spare faculty break room, is Dr. Paul Miller. Dr. Miller has his master's from Harvard and his BA and PhD from Georgetown University. He is a veteran of the war in Afghanistan, has served as an intelligence analyst for the CIA, has taught at the National Defense University and the RAND Corporation, served as director for Afghanistan and Pakistan on the National Security Council under Presidents Bush and Obama, and is currently both associate director for the Clements Center for National Security at the University of Texas in Austin, a distinguished scholar with the Strauss Center for International Security and Law, an affiliated faculty member with the Center for Russian, East European, and Eurasian Studies, a lecturer at the LBJ School of Public Affairs, and a fellow at the Ethics and Religious Liberty Convention. He lives in Austin with his wife, Jenna Lee, and their three kids, where he attends City Life Church. Dr. Miller, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Any one of that long list of accomplishments would be a good reason to have you on, but you're here specifically because you've recently published a book called American Power and Liberal Order, A Conservative Internationalist Grand Strategy. I've got to say, this is the best long-form articulation in defense of neoconservative foreign policy that I've read. So I'm happy to encourage people to pick up and read the book.
I think that's a compliment, although I actually deliberately don't use the word neoconservative anywhere in the book.
Oh, you don't need to.
It's a label I'm happy to leave behind. I think that label essentially means anybody whose foreign policy you dislike. It's a term of derogation or an insult. As the word was used, 40 or 50 years ago, it was sort of ex-liberals disillusioned by the left's excesses in the welfare state and disillusioned with the left's moral compromise with the Soviet Union.
Sure.
And so they kind of moved towards more conservative social policy, and they brought in a slightly more hawkish view towards foreign policy than the left of the 1960s. And if that's what the label means, I guess I'll wear it. But most people think it means a kind of forcible democracy promotion through regime change. And that's not at all what I stand for.
Right. And I guess I should qualify that by saying that there certainly are those nuances to it. But and granted, I'm no follower of, popular news shows or anything, but my impression is that it is just an association with sort of the Reagan and Bush approach to international relations, domestic policy, and so on. So you're in good company, yeah, for whatever it's worth.
Thank you. The label that most of the like-minded folks are using these days is the subtitle of my book, Conservative Internationalism.
Sure.
I didn't make up that label. It was actually a former Reagan administration official named Henry Now, who wrote a book called Conservative Internationalism just a couple of years ago. And that label has really taken hold on kind of rightward-leaning national security types in the last few years. And that's the label I happily apply to my book.
And again, I'm happy to encourage people to go read this book. It is worth reading. I should also point out that there is there's a longstanding antipathy between international relations and my subfield in the discipline of political science, that is political philosophy. So the IR people think that political philosophers sort of have their heads in the clouds and don't know anything about the real world, while the political philosophers think the IR folks are just a bunch of unsophisticated buffoons who don't stop to think before leaping to conclusions. I suspect there's also some resentment on the part of political philosophers, since in order to get a job in academia, you basically have to have a minor specialization in international relations. All that to say, Dr. Miller has done an excellent job of bridging the divide between these two subfields. He's absolutely unafraid to mention Plato on the same page as an analysis of contemporary Russian power. Before we get into some of that and into what the grand strategy is, I want to start with just a basic question that pops out of the subtitle, and I think this might actually tie in a little bit into the neoconservatism thing.
Yeah.
historically, conservatives have been very nervous about things like grand strategies and big picture formulas and trying to sort of ahistorically impose a rational scheme on the world. Older conservatives would say that smacks of Rousseau and will lead to the terror and the French Revolution and so on. Later conservatives would say that it sounds an awful lot like Marx and will lead to the death camps and Hitler and Stalin. So how can a conservative have a grand strategy?
Yeah. Well, so it kind of depends upon what you mean by the label conservative. That's another label that has changed meanings over the decades. It means one thing in a domestic context. I think it means sort of the old coalition between sort of Burkeans and libertarians and, again, neocons and social conservatives. And that was a political coalition that held for several decades. I think we maybe just saw its sunset in the last year.
Sure.
Conservatism can also mean just a temperament of caution, maybe skepticism towards epistemology and human agency. That could be another way of using the word. It also depends on what you mean by the word strategy or grand strategy, right? Is conservatism consistent with an attempt at strategizing? The way I think about sort of nations and their strategies, I think it's impossible to avoid having a strategy. Unless you're a random opportunist, you have a strategy for trying to achieve something in the world. You wake up in the morning and you have a strategy for getting out the door. I'm going to take a shower. I'm going to put on my clothes. I'm going to get in my car. I'm going to drive a route to work, right? So we all have a means for achieving a goal we want to achieve. And that's more or less what a strategy is. And even if you don't articulate what your strategy is revealed in your behavior. So a nation reveals its strategy through its decisions about deployments, military deployments, and budget allocations. So all nations have strategies. It just depends upon whether they're thought through, whether they're coherent, whether they make sense, whether they're effective. And I think it's a good idea as a national security professional for the United States to think through its strategy and to try to make it effective and to make it effective at achieving our national security interests. So obviously we have a strategy. We should try to make it a good one. That's, I think, inevitable whether you're conservative or whether you're liberal. Now, as a conservative internationalist, the conservative part of that simply means that I want to be realistic and pragmatic about how the world actually works. I want to rest my strategy on a true theory of political military cause and effect. I think liberal internationalists have a false understanding of cause and effect. They're very naive. They think the world, we can all just get along if we sign the right piece of paper, the right diplomatic agreement. But as a conservative internationalist, I recognize kind of the inescapability of human sin, of human fallibility, and thus the fact that we live in a world where there's people we're just not going to get along with, and political power often does flow from the barrel of a gun. And if you want to achieve anything in the world, you have to work within those realities to make them happen. I guess that's the conservative element of my conservative internationalism.
So what grand strategy should a conservative have? Give us your book in 5 minutes.
Yeah. So as an internationalist, that's in distinction to nationalists. And I didn't think that was a very important argument to make up until the 2016 election. The United States has had a default internationalist grand strategy for, I'd say, about 130 years, you know, since at least the Spanish-American War of 1898, if not before. There's a myth that America was, you know, traditionally isolationist. That's not true at all. Ever since our emergence as a great power on the world stage, the United States has understood our interests are inextricably entwined with the interests of other countries around the world and with the health of the overall international environment. That's what makes us internationalist. We want to foster a favorable international environment in which it's easier for us to pursue our own interests and our own security. That's what internationalism means. And again, that's been the default posture of American presidents and American secretaries of state for 130 plus years up until the Trump administration. I think the Trump administration is more accurately called a nationalist administration. That he talks about wanting to advance America first. He, and I could go through many examples, we'll talk about this maybe throughout this podcast, but I think he's broadly, more accurately characterized as a nationalist administration, where he defines American interests more narrowly, disconnected from the health of the international environment, disconnected from the interests of other states around the world. So his view, like, I don't disagree that we should pursue our interests first. I don't disagree with the idea of America first. I just think the way to get there is through fostering a healthy international environment. So internationalism is that belief, that we should foster a healthy international environment and work cooperatively with other nations to achieve our goals. If you want a pithy slogan, I'd say liberal order, or a culture of ordered liberty, is the outer perimeter of American security. Liberal order is the outer perimeter of American security. That's the argument of my book in short form. And again, add to that the conservative element to it, operating within pragmatic, prudent boundaries of the realities of political power. I'm not a liberal internationalist. I don't want to vest too much trust in international institutions. I think Woodrow Wilson was a terrible president. I think the Iran nuclear deal was a exact, a wonderful picture of what's wrong with liberal internationalism. They put so much faith in getting around a table, signing a piece of paper and saying, we can all get along now because we've got a piece of paper with signatures on it. And that's not accurate. That's just not how the world really works. And so that flavor of internationalism has gotten the United States into a lot of trouble over the decades. Conservative internationalism still aims at liberal goals, still aims at liberal order, still aims at sort of peace and stability around the world, but does so with more effective tools.
And one, I guess one concern that I've got with some of the things you say in the book is that at times it can sound similar to some of the defenses that we hear of Obamacare. You know, the thing we're doing isn't working, so we need to do it more and bigger. So are you saying that what we've been doing for the last 130 years, that's the right approach and we just need to really hammer that home? Or is there room for maybe being discontent with the way things are in the world now and saying, hey, look, this has led to a world that is more dangerous. This has led to a world that needs maybe a different tack from the American Republic.
Well, so I read the history of American foreign policy as a great success. I mean, look, we went from, 13 colonies to global superpower in about a century and a half. That's a pretty good track record. And our foreign policy over the long run is pursuing our power, which all states do, but trying to put them in the service of liberal ideals. And I think it's better to have them in the service of some ideals than no ideals at all. That would be quite bad. So I think that if you look at the track record of American foreign policy, particularly over the last 130 years, the United States has won two world wars and a Cold War, has effectively built this liberal order first within a smaller community of like-minded states on the western fringe of Europe, but it has gradually expanded to a nearly global scale in the post-Cold War era. This is, we are living now in the post-Cold War era at the kind of the high tide of liberalism in all of recorded history. So it seems to me an odd time to be skeptical of the prospects of kind of liberalism's spread and depth and sustainability. So I think liberal order is real. I think it's good. I think we should continue to use it as an effective instrument for our security.
And I think that that liberal order is something I'd like to hear you talk a little bit more about, because one word that never makes an appearance in your book under sort of its primary definition is virtue. You seem to sort of sub in liberal order as a synonym for that. Is that fair, or is there? I guess maybe what I'm wondering is it possible to be a virtuous state without being a liberal state in the world?
Yeah. Well, the word that does appear in my book quite a lot is justice, which I think is actually not. I think among books on grand strategy, you won't find many that talk about justice. But right. It was important to me to have some discussion of that in there. And the argument, a sub-argument I make in the book is that liberal order is an effective tool for a rough approximation of justice among nations. I think it's I don't think I'd go so far to say it's the only means to achieve justice or even a rough approximation of justice. But I think right now it's effective. I think it's we have enjoyed a period of peace, prosperity, and even human flourishing over the past century or so that is kind of unprecedented. And liberalism has been a very effective tool for building that world. And I don't want to undervalue that achievement, and I don't want to assume that it will just continue by inertia automatically without continued investment. And so I want to kind of cherish this achievement we've built through the use of liberalism as an instrumental tool, and not undervalue that. Does that make sense?
It does.
Yeah.
It does. And I think any follow-up on that, otherwise I want to sort of ask about that century of achievement, particularly in contrast.
Maybe this is a good time to talk about Reinhold Niebuhr. Again, maybe uniquely among books on grand strategy, I quote freely from a theologian, from Reinhold Niebuhr, the great sort of mid-20th century American theologian and thinker on American foreign policy. And Niebuhr is sort of sprinkled throughout the book, and I'm happy to also use his label, Christian Realism, as another label to describe the approach I'm advocating for. He started his career as a socialist and a pacifist after World War I, and he gradually abandoned those positions as before World War II, as kind of in the lead-up to the war. And he argued that despite our own weaknesses and despite our own sin, despite our own fallibility, we should not use those things as an excuse for inaction or moral paralysis in the face of greater evils like the Nazis. So he was an early advocate for intervention in the war there. And then after the war, he was an advocate for continued American leadership in the world, which he I think, rightly believed meant opposition to the Soviets. He did oppose the Vietnam War, but he was still, I'd say, a sort of a cold warrior. And his belief was that this was just, this was right, not because America is intrinsically virtuous, but because amongst a world of equal sinners, we still had to use power when necessary to fight evil and protect human flourishing and work for a rough approximation of justice in this world. And I think he was absolutely right. And I tried to build a kind of a Niebuhrian approach to the 21st century security environment.
Yeah, and you do quote Niebuhr frequently, to the point where I started thinking I should just get this Niebuhr book and read it.
There you go.
I've not read any Reinhold Niebuhr. I've read some Richard Niebuhr. But that's,
there you go, yeah.
They're siblings, right, or cousins?
They were siblings, and they agreed on most things. There was one or two famous disagreements they had, but Reinhold wrote more extensively on American foreign policy and its kind of place in the world, and Richard talked about other issues.
Sure.
The book to read by Reinhold Niebuhr, the one most people often cite first, is called The Irony of American History, which was published, I believe, in 1952, and so it's an early Cold War piece, and again, it's an argument more or less for sustained American leadership in the world. I actually kind of like better an earlier book that he wrote called The Children of Light and the Children of Darkness, published in 1944. The subtitle is really interesting. It was A Vindication of Democracy and a Critique of Its Traditional Defense. Niebuhr championed democracy as a good thing, but he criticized the traditional Enlightenment premises that were usually used to justify democracy. He thought that it was too naive, kind of Wilsonian, utopian,
sure,
and idealistic, Rousseauian. And he said, no, the real reason to defend democracy was, and he gave a kind of a Augustinian defense of democracy. It was actually kind of similar to the Federalist Papers, the idea that you have to diffuse power and check and balance it to create space for freedom, ordered liberty. And I think that's actually the correct way of thinking about the goodness of democracy. It's the best way of keeping power in check to allow space for human freedom and human flourishing.
And I think that sort of that historical approach is a good one to talk about for a minute. So right now I'm teaching a class with a colleague of mine on Athenian government or ancient Greek government, and talking about Athens, you know, the city city spends a lot of time conquering people around them, and that sort of in class has turned on several occasions into a broader discussion of how it really looks like historically the more democratic a state is, the more inherently imperialistic and militarily aggressive it tend to be, and at least so far I've not really been able to think of an exception to that. If that's accurate, how do we square that with something like liberal order, or do we need to just go the Walter McDougall route and say, you know what, they're aggressive and imperialistic, and that's just how they are, and it's still better than the alternative?
Yeah. Well, there's two responses. One is that when I say democracy, I'm using it as a shorthand. What I really mean is the mixed republic of checks and balances of constitutional order and liberty. It's really not democracy, not on the Athenian mode at all.
Sure.
It's not pure democracy. It's not plebiscitory democracy. If you want that, go with the progressive left. I think that they would be happy to advance that kind of democracy. I don't mean that at all. I do mean accountable governance under liberal norms and ideals. That has some representative element to it, elections and voting, majoritarian rule, but with important protections for minority rights and all that. And I would speculate that that sort of mixed republic has fewer tendencies than the mass democracy of Athens towards international aggressiveness.
Or at least it's slower in its tendencies to that.
Perhaps so, yeah. The other response I'd give is to talk about the democratic peace theory. Whether or not democracies have maybe a crusading impulse against non-democracies, they certainly don't against each other. And this plays a really big role in my book, in my argument. The democratic peace theory says that democracies don't fight each other, and it's essentially true. I think if you look at the statistics, people have done multivariate regressions on the data going back two centuries, or if you look at just individual case studies, I'm comfortable saying that democracies almost never, virtually never, or actually never really fight each other. And the fact that scholars debate on marginal cases, was this a democracy fighting another democracy?
Right.
It kind of proves the point that by and large, in 98 to 99% of the cases, democracies don't fight each other. And that's such an important insight that I'm happy to rest a large part of American grand strategy on that one truth. As democracy spreads, it also spreads a zone of peace and stability, and it eliminates potential threats to the United States. I just think that's a true statement. Does that mean we should forcibly go out and compel regime change and compel democratization? No, absolutely not. No one actually makes the argument that we should. I mean, that's kind of a straw man argument. No one says we should invade the world and force them to all take democracy. No one makes that argument. So we all agree we shouldn't be doing that. Nonetheless, when there's an opportunity for the United States to kind of put its finger on the scale and tip the balance in favor of liberalism, we absolutely should, because that is we should do so selfishly. It actually contributes to our own security when we do that. It pushes back that outer perimeter of American security and expands that zone of peace and stability.
Hmm. Yeah. So that actually sort of answers my next question, was going to be, well, if we only are at peace with people when they look like us, I suppose one way you could go is say, look, not much of the world looks like us, therefore we just will stay home. But the other way you could go is saying, well, we will remake the world in our image so we don't have to fight them, and start leaning in that sort of hubristic direction of...
Well, except I'd say quite a lot of the world does look like us now. Because, you know, when we first said all men are created equal, you know, government by the consent of the governed, back then it was a ridiculous thing to say. You know, we were the only country in the world founding our own constitution on that idea. And today, most of the world does. Most of the world agrees with the principles of American exceptionalism. So, as I said, we're living at the high point of liberalism in all of recorded human history. And that's a wonderful thing. And it's kind of an amazing thing that much of the world, including, depends upon how you count, including about a third of the so-called non-Western world, for the sake of the microphone, I'm using air quotes here because I think the categories of West and non-Western is kind of silly. But something like a third of the so-called non-Western countries in the world are also democratic or liberal countries living under some form of constitutional accountable governance. So it says to me that much of the world does look like us in that sense. These ideals can be adapted to different cultural contexts. India, Japan, gigantic and successful non-Western democracies. You could argue that examples like that, you could argue that what I have argued in my book is that the continued success of liberal ideals around the world can happen because we live in a world dominated by liberal powers. The fact that the richest and strongest country in the world for two centuries has been a liberal state, and here I'm talking about the United Kingdom first, and then the United States, creates a milieu, a cultural environment in which liberalism becomes the default for countries that are transitioning. So, you know, India after decolonization, or Japan after World War II, or two dozen states since the end of the Cold War, as they've transitioned regimes, they'd gravitate towards some liberal form of governance, again, by default. And I think that's a good thing.
Just one last theoretical question here before we get practical. If one of my anti-federalist friends were here, they would insist on asking some variation of the question. You know, liberal order is historically based on independent, mostly autonomous local government. How do you put your thumb on the scales and tip the balance of that in other nations? On I guess that maybe that is skewing practical as well. But if the strength of the American Republic is that, you know, the city I live in really doesn't need the federal government for most of what it does most of the time,
yeah,
even if that's, you know, technically no longer true, how do we convince others to do the same when what we want to see is the big national changes that we enjoy that are based on this local thing?
Well, it's not all up to us. You know, this is... perhaps where the conservative part of my conservative internationalism comes in. Maybe a liberal internationalist would answer this differently, and they'd talk about having to go in and rewrite constitutions and train everybody in the art of being free. I don't think that that's always true. Where the United States can make a difference depends on a case-by-case situation. Look, in the case of West Germany, we had to first, you know, overthrow the Nazis.
Right.
But after that, and this is a case study I'd like to learn more about, the United States had a pretty invasive occupation for actually just a year, and then it pretty quickly, we pretty quickly withdrew a lot of the military occupation liaison teams that were governing West Germany, and we held elections in West Germany in like February of 1946. It was kind of at the local level.
Right.
We built up to the national level over 5 years or something like that. So there might be a case study there for a historian listening to this to learn more about how we did it in West Germany. I don't think that's a cookie-cutter template that we can slap down anywhere else or everywhere else. In a lot of cases, I think foreign aid can be the right tool for encouraging the growth of liberal ideals. Ronald Reagan called it the infrastructure of democracy. He founded the National Endowment for Democracy in 83, I think. He wanted to use American foreign aid to fund not bureaucrats, but the free press, labor unions, civil society organizations. And when you empower civil society with resources, they will stand up and do their thing without much more interference from us. They've got their own interests. I'm especially keen on funding free media because in Eastern Europe, for example, they did not have the opportunity to practice free media for decades prior to the fall of the Iron Curtain. We have, to some extent, helped fund independent newspapers and TV stations and teach them what investigative journalism looks like. And that's like an engine. When you turn that engine on, it will start to help keep government accountable. It will root out corruption. It will shed the light of transparency and all that. And that can, by itself, become an independent driver of further progress in democratization or liberalization. So, you know, on the one hand, West Germany, you know, we invaded, occupied, and did regime change and really, you know, had a pretty heavy hand. In a lot of other places, it's a very light touch. And I think you have to take it on a case-by-case basis. Most of the world doesn't need, you know, regime change. Most of the world needs the lighter touch.
Where in the world does need regime change? I'm just curious. I know nothing about the contemporary world,
yeah.
So you could give me any answer, and I wouldn't know that you're right or wrong. But
well, so again, I don't advocate that we go out and invade the world. Particularly because a lot of the places in the world are not strategically important to the United States, you know. And again, this is where the conservative part of my internationalism comes in. I want to prioritize very strongly based upon what regions of the world are most important to us. And that means, if you look at the numbers, primarily Europe and East Asia. By far and away, those are the regions of the world with the greatest concentration of global GDP, the greatest concentration of American trade, the greatest concentration of military spending, the greatest number of nuclear powers. Right, so all the things that we care about, places where we can get rich and people who want to kill us, that's in Europe and in East Asia. Those are the places I'm willing to expend more resources in. And the Middle East actually doesn't rank number one, two, or number three. I think South Asia is more important than the Middle East. So if there's a crisis in Europe or East Asia, that's where we should spend most of our resources. That means the war in Ukraine is potentially the most important security crisis of the 21st century right now. And I am willing to spend a lot more resources in Ukraine than I am in Syria right now. I think the war in Ukraine is way more important than the war in Syria. And I'd like to see us come and partner with the Ukrainian government. I'd like to see us give them security assistance, give them weapons, give them training, help them fight for their own legitimate self-defense. And if there's an opportunity to also give them civilian assistance to improve Ukrainian governance and make the Ukrainian government more attractive to the Eastern Ukrainians, that might be a good idea too. That might be a strategic use of foreign aid to bolster liberal order in the world's most important strategic region. So there's a place, again, that's not regime change, but there's a place where both security assistance and civilian foreign aid could make a real difference in a really important region. The other case where you just asked, you know, where do we need regime change? North Korea. North Korea is the worst government on the planet. It's the worst place in the world to live. It's a barbaric regime. They brainwash their people with an inhuman ideology. They starve their own people. They're guilty of countless war crimes. They sponsor terrorism. I could go on and on and on. They're plainly the worst on the planet. I'm not saying we should launch an offensive war tomorrow, but North Korea has given pretty regular provocation to South Korea and to China and to the United States. And I'm fairly convinced that at some point in our working lives, at some point in the next 20, 30, 40 years, North Korea will no longer, the North Korean government is no longer going to exist, either because they've launched a war that they can't win and they get destroyed, or because they collapse from within like the Soviet Union. One or the other, I don't know which is going to happen, but I'm pretty sure that the situation on the Korean Peninsula is unsustainable. And I think the United States has to be prepared to help the South Koreans, who should lead the effort, to rebuild the North. And that's going to be a very difficult and expensive effort. But it's the one place right now where I think regime change and nation building, we have to be prepared to do that.
And I guess your answer to that sort of leads into my next question. If you were, you know, dictator of the State Department and the Defense Department for a day, what changes would you make in the policy? What specific practical things would you want to see happen? So you've mentioned, you know, aid to the Ukraine, something in North Korea. What else would you want to see?
Yeah, well, for North Korea, I'd say just be prepared. Right. I'm not advocating the sort of offensive war there. I'm saying we need to be ready for the day when it becomes necessary. So I do agree that the United States military posture should be probably a little bit bigger than it is today. It's actually right now the smallest footprint we've had since World War II. President Obama oversaw continued retrenchment that I think was unhelpful. So I'd like to see probably a slightly larger active duty military force. I don't know quite what that number looks like. But I think sustaining the military underpinnings of liberal order requires a little bit bigger footprint on our part and our allies. I absolutely agree. The allies need to contribute more. We've been telling our allies that for 50 years. I'd like to see us actually get serious about the war in Afghanistan. I could talk on that for several hours. That's been my specialty. And it's very discouraging to me that we have a commander-in-chief who I don't think has ever actually said the word Afghanistan. He's inherited America's longest war, and I'm not sure he or his team are really paying attention to it. So I'd like to pay attention to Afghanistan. I'd like to grow the size of the military. I would take a close look at our posture in East Asia. I'm actually not certain if the overall number needs to grow or shrink, but I'd want to maybe look at the distribution of capabilities and where they're located. We've got bases in Guam and Japan and South Korea and Australia. I just want to maybe change up that mix a little. You're asking what policies would I change in the American government? There's plenty I'd change in the allies' governments.
Sure.
The State Department, look, I'm happy to grow the foreign aid budget by a factor of 10. So long as we applied it or prioritized its use by this kind of framework I've suggested, investing in the infrastructure of democracy around the world. I'd like to see a lot of investment in Eastern Europe and in Turkey. I'd like to see investment in, you know, the Philippines, South Korea. They're having trouble with their democracy right now. They just impeached their own president. And I'd like to see investment in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and India, really India. India is the great opportunity of the 21st century. It's the other rising economic superpower. we share concerns over both the rise of China and over jihadist terrorism. And if we can invest in India, if they would accept our investment, both a security investment to bolster their security forces and investment in, I'd say, infrastructure, counter-corruption, rural development, that could transform India from what it is, which is already quite good, into the other major pillar of liberal order in the world. They really could grow into that role right alongside the United States, Europe, and Japan. And I'd like to see that happen. That would give liberal order more resilience, more depth. So I think India is the great opportunity in the 21st century. I could go on. There's plenty of other changes I could make, but yeah.
So let's get a little theological here for a minute. Then, if you had written this book when you and I were growing up, as a conservative internationalist, I imagine that you would have, you know, the first chapter would have been on Israel. And how, particularly as a Christian conservative internationalist, you know, American support for Israel is actually, you know, forcing God to support us.
Right.
as it is in the book, you talk about Israel a little bit, but it is by no means front and center. And I assume that's not necessarily for theological purposes, but maybe talk both about the conservative internationalist side of that. And then if you want to touch on the theology, you can, but you don't have to.
Yeah. Well, for reference, the portion of my book on Israel was adapted from an article. And the article is longer and does address some of the theological concerns called the U.S., what is it called? Evangelicals, the United States, and Israel, or what is it? Evangelicals and U.S. Foreign Policy Towards Israel, in the journal called Survival. It was published back in 2014, I think. Evangelicals, Israel, and U.S. Foreign Policy is what the title was. So I am not a dispensationalist, right? I'd put myself more in the Reformed camp. I guess maybe covenant theology is the one that stands in distinction to dispensationalism. So I don't understand contemporary Israel to be the inheritor of God's promises to Abraham in Genesis 15. I think the church is the inheritor of those promises, a la Romans 9, I think, where, you know, Paul says that, you know, those who inherit the promise, those who, you know, share in Abraham's faith are the inheritors of the promise. So I guess that's how I approach that theologically. I think Israel is part of liberal order, right? So I think I have no problem at all supporting Israel in the sense that we should kind of support all of our sort of like-minded friends and allies around the world. Israel is a free market democracy. It shares our way of looking at the world, and those are good things. Israel is also one of the most aggressive espionage threats in the United States, which is not well known. Most people think of the Russians, they think of the Chinese. Actually, the Mossad is quite aggressive in the United States. Not because they want to do damage to the United States, but because they want to discern the motives of individual American policymakers and figure out if we're really going to come to Israel's defense if push came to shove. Regardless of their motive, I think it's unprofessional, so to speak, for the largest recipient of U.S. aid to also be one of the largest espionage threats. And so I would love to see a bit of a tougher line against Israeli espionage, for example. We give a lot of money to Israel. Again, they are the largest recipient of U.S. foreign aid ever in history. We've given more money to Israel than we give to Western Europe under the Marshall Plan. And quite a lot of it is for Israeli defense. I don't have a problem with that. I do think that a lot of that aid could be trade. Israel is a fairly rich country. It's the richest country we give money to. I'd love to reserve our foreign aid for countries that can't afford to pay, that are poor and developing, and we just need to, you know, give them money. So there are some tweaks I'd make in the U.S.-Israeli bilateral relationship, but by and large, I think it's fine to support Israel. There's a view out there that says our support for Israel is one of the main drivers of the problems in the Middle East, and if we need to be nicer to the Arabs and the Arab states and be less nice to Israel, and that'll fix everything. I totally don't agree with that. Fixing the dispute between Israel and the Palestinians is not the magic key that will fix the entire Middle East. That's a complete myth. The Arab states have a whole host of problems, from corruption to poverty to lack of human investment, human development, that will not be fixed if Israel and the Palestinians ever do come to an agreement. And so the underlying pathologies in the region will long outlast whatever we do with the Israelis and whatever the Israelis do with the Palestinians.
And
one more thing. I actually just care less about this than most foreign policy professionals. I think it doesn't matter to American national security, and I don't think it matters theologically either. So I'm happy to recommend that the American president, whoever it is, ignore this. I think the Israeli-Palestinian dispute is irrelevant to American security, so we don't need to care about this that much.
Yeah, and you mentioned a couple of times increased foreign aid in some form or another. I think some of our listeners might bristle at that a little bit because there is a prejudice that we give so much money to other nations, it's crippling our own our own national budget, and that's simply not true. Right? I mean, we could double our foreign aid budget, and it wouldn't affect basically anything. Yeah. It would be a fraction of a percentage of our overall budget.
That's correct. Our foreign aid budget is a rounding error in the federal budget or compared to the American economy. Most Americans, there are public opinion polls out there where most Americans believe that we spend 20 to 25% of our budget on foreign aid, and they say, I would be much more comfortable with only 10% of our budget would go to foreign aid. And the reality is we spend less than 1% of our budget on foreign aid. And so if we got to 10%, that'd be great. I'd love that. I think it'd be wonderful.
We have to skim something else out.
That's right, yeah. So I do think that an increase in foreign aid would be great. I know that conservatives particularly get skittish about that because they think it's some form of international social engineering. They think that it's the international equivalent of progressivism. And I don't think that's sometimes that is true, but it doesn't have to be true. Again, when you fund the free media, that's not social engineering. That's just empowering civil society, which conservatives should be able to get behind. And I want to kind of put resources behind those independent non-state actors that really can make a society thrive.
Right. So I may not want our foreign aid, as a conservative, I may not want our foreign aid dispersed by the National Endowment for the Arts.
Right.
But that doesn't mean none.
That's right. Exactly. So. Exactly. And almost none of our foreign aid goes to food aid. A lot of people think that it's just humanitarian charity. First of all, I have no problem with humanitarian charity, but that makes up a tiny fraction of a tiny fraction of our foreign aid budget. It's just almost nothing. I'd love to see if give more. Yeah.
Yeah, you may not know this. I'm always kind of curious how much actual food do we give, or do we just give money?
I believe we do give food. I'm a little fuzzy on the details. I think that the American government actually buys up surplus stocks of like wheat and keeps it in sacks. And then when there's a famine, I think we do actually give out food. I'm not sure how much that is. By dollar amount, it's very small compared to our budget.
Yeah. Yeah, it is one of the things that we are very good at producing far larger quantities of than we actually need.
Yeah,
which is changing as farmers are dying off and not being replaced. That will eventually no longer be the case. But anyway, that's maybe a tangent. So if someone's listening to this and they go out and they buy your book and they read your book and think, hey, I want to know more. So assuming they've read your book, what other books would you send people to pick up? So we've mentioned Niebuhr. You mentioned Now.
Here's the books that I guess I would agree with or think are along the same lines broadly. Robert Kagan wrote a short book called The World America Made, and that might actually be a good book to read before my book because it's short, it's accessible, it's not an academic book, it's more like a pamphlet. It's like you could read it in a couple hours. And he's made the case similarly for American kind of engagement in the world. A much deeper, denser academic book is John Eikenberry's book, Liberal Leviathan, published in 2008. He does get more, he's more in the camp of liberal internationalism, so there's a few things in there I disagree with, but he does give a far denser academic treatment for why this works. Walter Russell Mead, kind of anything he writes is great. His book Special Providence is still just a great text in sketching out the intellectual terrain of American foreign policy thinking. And if you want to understand Trump, then reading Walter Russell Mead's chapter on Jacksonianism, I think, is really, really good. But Mead's more recent book called God and Gold, the world, the United States and the United Kingdom built, something like that. It's a kind of a strange book, honestly, but it's good. He gives the argument for liberalism, for free market capitalism. His book is more about capitalism than about political democracy, but he gives the argument for why that is an almost invincible agent of world transformation. It's really remarkable. And he also gets theological in the book as well. So those are a couple of works. Yeah, that's good places. Those are the ones I would agree with. There's plenty that I disagree with. If you want disagreements, read Barry Posen's book, Restraint. Read Christopher Lane's book, The Peace of Illusions. Read anything by the Cato Institute. they actually just published, the head of the Cato Institute just published an article this morning critiquing my previous article assessing the Obama administration's foreign policy. I criticized Obama for his legacy of restraint, and this guy from Cato published and said, "Are you crazy? Obama was not he was not an advocate of restraint. He was nowhere near restrained enough."
He was not an advocate of restraint, but he was incompetent enough that I think he ended up being restrained.
I would make the argument in my previous article that I think Obama had instincts for restraint. He wanted to do less than he thought he was learning from history, from the Bush administration, right, by doing less, by pulling out of Iraq, pulling out of Afghanistan, not getting involved in Syria, not getting involved in Ukraine, and doing Libya the way he did Libya was also, I think, a restrained way of doing it. So I think that there are signposts of restraint within the Obama administration. And here's my prediction. I think we're going to see more continuity between Obama and Trump in foreign policy over the long run. I think Trump will take some of those instincts for restraint and take them further.
Right. I remember when Obama was running, he talked, I don't know, it was weird, and maybe it's been a while since I've looked at this, because, you know, it's been 8 years at this point, but he seemed to sort of talk the language of restraint in some ways, but then he would say something like, "We never should have gotten involved in Iraq. We should have been in Sudan instead." Well, that's sort of restraint, I guess, but it's, we're involved in the wrong places, you know.
So Obama, he is a curious case. I think he often spoke the language of liberal internationalism, right, because it's the default language, particularly of Democrats, right, of Woodrow Wilson and Jimmy Carter and Bill Clinton to a lesser extent. And so Obama inherited that language and that rhetoric of that way of talking about America's role in the world. He's all for human rights and democracy, but you have to do it with the velvet glove instead of the iron fist, right? And again, Woodrow Wilson it was a terrible president. I mean, he failed in everything. And unfortunately, his template for engaging in the world is still the default template for quite a lot of the foreign policy establishment. And Obama inherited that. I think he also recognized some of its weaknesses, thus the tension, his right, instinct for restraint. He actually wanted to do less. And I think overall he ended up being fairly ineffective in most of his foreign policy. You know, there was one of those polls by historians of presidential performance that just came out a week or so ago. It's the first one to rank Obama, and they rank him like 12th best president overall, right? And third best for social justice. But they themselves ranked him 24th for his handling of foreign affairs, which I think actually may be a bit too high. But even these historians who are favorable towards Obama recognize that his foreign policy handling was not great.
Well, I assume, I mean, who knows what we'll see with Trump, because who knows what he'll tweet from one moment to the next. But I assume a similar tension, because we see him on the one hand, you know, arguing for we shouldn't be involved in these wars, and I was against the wars all along. And then on the other hand, we're going to flatten ISIS, right, and we're going to, you know, we're going to hit them with everything we got, and we're going to win. And there is that just that disconnect that I assume Obama on some level knew there was a tension there. I don't know that Trump does.
Yeah. Yeah, no, Trump, so Trump is not an isolationist.
Right.
Trump is a militarist and a nationalist. Right. So he, I think, won't retrench completely. He'll retrench some. I think he will. I think he's more inclined to retrench because he doesn't believe in the value of the international alliances and NATO and Eastern Europe and all that. When he engages, it's going to be largely through the military instrument, and it will be kind of bomb and go home. Right. I think that's his instinct. There's actually a new book out called Donald Trump, The Making of a Worldview by Charlie Lederman and Brendan Sims. It's a very short book. It's mostly a compendium of primary sources. They've looked at every interview that Trump has given since 1980 and extracted his foreign policy comments to show the consistency in Trump's foreign policy thinking. He's not random. He's not erratic. He actually knows his own mind, and he is a nationalist, a Jacksonian. In trade, he's a protectionist, and it's been very consistent for 40 years. The guy's been on message for 40 years. And he says that he's not a fan of boots on the ground. He is a fan of air power. He did support the war in Iraq tepidly at the beginning, but very quickly turned against it. He supported strongly the campaign in Libya in 2011, and then he turned against it. So he seems to get all militaristic at the beginning, and he's all for bombing, and then he wants to go home right after that. He often criticizes the nation building and the large counterinsurgency campaigns of the Bush years. So I think under Trump, we will see he's going to want to dump a lot of bombs on Syria, declare victory, announce that ISIS has been defeated, and then withdraw. That's what he's going to want to do. There's a countervailing tendency here, and that is he's also, I think, tends to get personally invested in the success of his initiatives. He tends to feel personally threatened. You know, his masculinity is threatened if somebody doesn't do his will. And so if he dumps a lot of bombs and declares victory, but then somebody, you know, then ISIS launches another terrorist attack, I think Trump may feel compelled to demonstrate his strength by bombing again, or bombing again, or maybe even sending troops. So Trump may actually get drawn into a broader campaign against his own wishes.
Or just blame someone else for it.
Or blame someone else for it, yeah.
Actually, since Trump has come up several times, in the book you specifically endorse, if I'm remembering this correctly, you specifically endorse something that he specifically is radically against. That is the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Oh, yeah. Okay, I thought you were about to bring up the wall along Mexico.
Oh, well, yeah. There's the wall, too. Yeah. Which, you know, that's an interesting argument. But let's do TPP and then if you want to talk about the wall.
Sure.
Why should we endorse this bad deal?
TPP. I briefly endorse it in, I think, a single paragraph in the book, mainly because I think that greater economic ties and deepening economic engagement between the United States and the rest of East Asia is a good thing. It'll make us richer on the whole, but more importantly, from a sort of strategic or national security standpoint, it keeps us invested in the region and keeps them invested in the relationship with the United States. If we don't do that, which we're now not going to, thanks to President Trump, I think the rest of the region will find itself more gradually economically bound to China. Hmm. And when you're economically bound to a country, there's a tremendous pressure to see the world their way and to define your interests with that country and to bandwagon with them, to use the IR term. If we are comfortable with China being the regional hegemon of all East Asia, well, we've just helped pave the way for that. But if we want to prevent a single power from being the hegemon, if we want to disperse power, if we want to keep a system in place in East Asia where no one power calls the shots, then we should have done the TPP. That would have enabled an economic check and balance among the powers of East Asia. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I didn't know, certainly. So tell us why you're in favor of free flow of immigrants across the U.S. border and against a wall.
Well, no, actually, in the book, I actually support the wall.
That's true.
Yeah,
Although not maybe a literal wall.
That's right. So for clarification, I wrote this book over the course of the previous 5 years. So I developed this largely in response to Obama, not Trump. I think Trump makes one single appearance in the book. So I now comment regularly on Trump just because he's in the headlines, but the book was largely not written in response to him. As I was thinking through Homeland Security, I recognized that the United States has a lot of vulnerabilities in our Homeland Security, and I advocate greater cybersecurity, I advocate a domestic intelligence agency, and I advocate greater border fencing. Not primarily for immigration policy, although, you know, look, it needs change, right? But mainly for national security reasons. The land border is one of the last unexploited weaknesses in American Homeland Security. Therefore, it's the one most likely to be exploited by future terrorists. Al-Qaeda is still out there. ISIS is out there. And they want to kill us, and they want to come into the homeland and kill us. And it only takes one or a team of a dozen. It only took 19 guys to do 9/11. So I am fairly confident that there are sort of future terrorists out there planning the next 9/11 who understand that the easiest way to get into America now is not on a plane, but by just flying to Guatemala and walking north. If you're persistent enough, you can make it. Because of that, I would like to see a greater physical barrier on the southern border, whether it's a literal fence or drones or sensors or more border patrolmen. I don't know what the best answer is. But plainly, if we are unable to control the flow of millions of people across the border, that does leave us exposed to terrorism.
Well, there's a lot more that we could talk about. We're coming up on our time. So, Dr. Miller, thank you again for coming on the show. Listeners, please do go out and pick up a copy of American Power and Liberal Order, a conservative internationalist grand strategy, available from Georgetown University Press. And thank all of you for listening to City of Man, part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippic. For more information about our own or any other shows on the network, please visit ChristianHumanist.org. We would appreciate it if you would review us on iTunes. That's the best way to help people find the show. You can also like us on Facebook at facebook.com/cityofmanpodcast, or leave us messages there or contact us directly at cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com. On behalf of the Absent Ed song, let me remind you to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's.
This land is your land, and this land is my land. From the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of highway.